As has been alluded to, we are starting a series this week looking at the resurrection. And if I'm honest, I'm a mix of incredibly excited about this series and also a little bit daunted by it. The reason I'm excited and the reason I'm daunted by it is the same, really, which is that it's pretty clear that Christianity, when it launched, was what could be described as a resurrection movement. That was the heartbeat of it. If you read through the book of Acts, the early church, and you see what they are talking about the resurrection. That is what they're talking about. Christianity was launched by the resurrection. The resurrection was, in some ways, its central, unique belief. And so, to understand Christianity, you have to understand the resurrection. You can't understand Christianity without understanding resurrection. You can't understand, even if you're not interested in Christianity itself, you can't understand why it took hold of the world in the way it did without understanding the resurrection. So that makes it really exciting, because we're talking about what is in some ways the centerpiece of the Christian faith. But of course, that makes it exciting, also makes it a bit daunting, because it's kind of everything. Like, everything is encompassed in this. And trying to work out where you go and how you talk about it has just felt like, it felt like a bit of a weight on my shoulders over the past months as I've been trying to read this. And so what I really want to do as we start is just manage some expectations, give some sense of what we're actually talking about. So we're going to be talking about resurrection. And I want to say that this series on the resurrection, it's going to be about three things, okay? There's going to be three things that, I'm going to tell you three things it is going to be about and one thing it's not going to be about, this series on the resurrection. And we're doing it in the run-up to Easter, for obvious reasons, but we're also doing it because what we like to do as a church, although most of the time we like to just work through books of the Bible, we also like to, every now and again, just go, hey, let's look at one of the key bits of Christianity and unpack it. And so resurrection is an obvious one to do at some point, and now is the time to do it. So three things that this series is about. The first thing it's about is it's about a past event. So this is going to be a series. It's going to be looking at a past event, namely the resurrection of Jesus Christ on that first Easter. So we'll spend some time during the season, during the series, looking at that past event. It's also going to be about a present reality. If you look at the way that the resurrection is talked about in the New Testament, one of the key ways it's talked about is as being a reality that is already right now enjoyed by Christians, by those who've put their faith in the risen Lord Jesus. The power of the resurrection breathes new life into our hearts so that we live out resurrection-shaped lives. And so part of this series is going to be asking the question, what is a resurrection-shaped life? What is the life of the resurrection people? Like, what does that look like? How do you live that out? So it's going to be about a past event. It's going to be about a present reality. And you've already guessed it. It's going to be about a future hope. Okay? So it's going to be about something that is going to happen. And namely, a hope that one day there will be a bodily resurrection where all who are dead are raised and all who are still living are transformed. They are the three things that this series is going to explore. It's going to explore what does it look like to believe in that past event, the resurrection of Jesus? What does it look like to live out resurrection-shaped lives? And what does it look like to have a future hope in a bodily resurrection? Now, all of this means, crucially, that this series is not about one thing, and it's not about the one thing that many of our minds go to when we think of resurrection. This is not a series about what happens when you die. You see, when I speak of the resurrection, many of our minds go there and think, okay, this is a series about what happens when I die. But I just want to make it as clear as I can. We know what happens when we die, and it is not bodily resurrection. When we die, our bodies decay. We can observe it, we can watch it, we can see it happen. They do not rise. No, when we die, we mourn the loss of that person. We grieve their absence. We don't think, oh, don't worry about it, maybe they'll get out the other side. We don't walk down the street and expect to see them the next day. Okay, that's not what any of us expect. It's not what Christians should expect, because this is not a series about that. That is not what the Bible means when it talks about resurrection. So this is a series about those three things. It is not a series about what happens when we die. That's not to say there isn't a conversation to be had about what happens when we die. There probably is, but it's minor in comparison to the conversation about the resurrection. Now, given that we know what happens to our bodies when they die, because we've seen it, and given the fact that every human being throughout history has known this, then this begs the question, why would anybody believe in the resurrection? There's probably some of you here today who fall into that camp. You just go, why on earth would anyone believe in the resurrection, a bodily resurrection, when we can see what happens? We can observe it. And we can see not only what happens, but we can see that it always happens. 100% of the time it happens. Why would anyone believe in a physical resurrection? And the reason I ask this is because we know that by the time Jesus was on earth doing his ministry, we know that there were a group of people who already believed in a bodily resurrection. We know that because we see Jesus debating with them. So famously, the Pharisees did believe in a bodily resurrection, the Sadducees didn't. So there was a group of people within Judaism who already believed in a physical bodily resurrection before Jesus had ever been raised. They believed that at some future point, people would be physically raised. But why on earth would you believe that before the resurrection of Jesus? Like, maybe you can get your head around why you believe that after Jesus has died and come back to life, because you kind of got a model for it. But why would anyone believe that before that moment? It's never happened. There's no reason to believe it would happen, you would assume. Given that they knew exactly the same as you and I know, that dead people stay dead, then why had they managed to come to a belief that there would be some future physical resurrection? And as far as we know, other than that group within Judaism, no one else in the ancient world believed that. So if you look at any of the writings of the ancient world, specifically if you look at people like Homer and Plato and Socrates, you know, these great thinkers of the ancient world, none of those guys believed that there was any hope of physical resurrection. So Homer and Plato, they might have believed that our souls go on living. You might have come across that idea. It might be something that you're kind of familiar with. It might be even something that you believe, that our souls will go on living. For some, that was a belief that we go on to a lesser type of existence, you know, a kind of disembodied existence, which is not quite as good as being actually alive, but better than nothing. For others, it was kind of a belief that this was better than the physical world. The physical world was evil or damaged in some way, and what we wanted was a non-physical state, our souls to live on. And so the ancient world was basically divided into two groups. Those who knew the resurrection couldn't happen, though they might have wanted it to. And those who said they didn't want it to happen, knowing full well that it couldn't anyway. That was the ancient world and how they thought about resurrection. It was into that world that the people within Israel, the Jewish people, that they began to formulate a belief in a future resurrection. And to understand why that happened, we have to understand how they understood the whole world, the character of God. What was their worldview that led them to that place? And so we're going to go to Genesis 1. We're going to do the resurrection from Genesis 1. My goal in this series is to start in Genesis 1 and finish in Revelation 22. And we've got 5 weeks to go from the beginning to the end. That's my goal. But I want to go to Genesis 1 because I think this is, in some ways, one of the most important passages for understanding why ancient Israel came to believe in a bodily resurrection. Now, if you don't know Genesis 1, let me just introduce you to it. Genesis 1 is a poem, okay? It's clearly a poem. And it's a poem written to describe God's creation of the world. And it begins with the creation of light, and it reaches its climax with the creation of mankind and God resting on the seventh day. So it goes from the beginning, day one, God creates light, to the end of day six, he creates humanity, and then day seven, he rests. That's the pattern of Genesis 1. And I just want to pick it up on the sixth day. I'm going to put the passage up here. You might be able to read it, but you can always also find it in your Bibles. I'd tell you the page number, but I don't know it, but my guess is near the beginning. Probably a number less than 10, unless there's a huge preface. Genesis 1. I'm going to just pick it up at verse 26, I think it is. 24 is where I'm going to pick it up. Page 3, there you go, thank you. And God said, let the land produce living creatures according to their kinds, the livestock, the creatures that move along the ground, and the wild animals, each according to its kind. And it was so. God made the wild animals according to their kinds, the livestock according to their kinds, all the creatures that move along the ground according to their kinds. And God saw that it was good. Then God said, let us make mankind in our image, in our likeness, so that they may rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky, over the livestock and all the wild animals, and over all the creatures that move along the ground. So God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and increase in number. Fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky and over every living creature that moves on the ground. Then God said, I give you every seed-bearing plant on the face of the whole earth and every tree that has fruit with seed in it. They will be yours for food. And to all the beasts of the earth and all the birds in the sky and all the creatures that move along the ground, everything that has the breath of life in it, I give you every green plant for food. And it was so. God saw all that he had made, and it was very good. And there was evening and there was morning the sixth day. I'm going to stop there. So, do you see where we've got to by the end of God's creation? This is it. Then God rests, day seven. So this is the end of his creation. God has made the entirety of the physical world, the planets, the stars, vegetation, animals, people. And he has made it, we are told, crucially, to be what? Good. In fact, he gets to the end of day six, and having said about each bit, oh, it was good, and it was good, it was good, the end of each day, or during the day, he says it was good. At the end of day six, he says, he looks at it all, and it's very good. Okay, it's now, he looks at it, he goes, this is what I've made, and it is very good. God has poured all of his goodness into his creation, into the universe that he has made. And he looks at it and he goes, this is a very, very good creation. This is full of my goodness. In 2001, I went to this place, which you can't see, but you wouldn't be able to see anyway. Now, there's a reason why you can't see it. Part of the reason you can't see it is because it's incredibly light in here and that projector's not powerful enough. But the other reason why it's very seen is because I took this picture on a camera 25 years ago, and then I printed out on a piece of paper, and then I took a picture of it with my mobile phone, and then I put it up there. So it's not the greatest quality picture you will ever see. But it is a picture of the Iguazu Falls. If you want to see what they look like, you can look at that telly just there and you'll actually be able to see it. It's a picture of the Iguazu Falls. So in 2001, I spent some time in Brazil. My mum randomly found this week, Ben's trip to Brazil, 2001 to 2002. I spent 6 months in Brazil. There's a whole section on the Iguazu Falls in it. So if you wanna have a look, you can. I went to the Iguazu Falls. It's on the border between Brazil and Argentina. And it is absolutely huge. It's the largest waterfall system in the world. There's 275 different cascades within it. It spans almost 3 kilometers. And I remember when I was there just being blown away by the sheer volume of water. I don't know if you've ever been to like an actual huge waterfall. Like, it doesn't have to be the Iguazu Falls, but I guess any of them, you know, Niagara, Victoria. I don't know if you've ever been to a huge wall. The volume of water just pouring over all the time. I couldn't quite get my head around it because it doesn't seem to ever really rain in Brazil. So I was like, where's all this water coming from? I don't know. I'm not a scientist, but I'm sure there's an explanation. But there's just this amount of water. And I'm like, how is that all this water just constantly able to pour over this? And I remember just standing there on the side of it and just being slightly awestruck by the power of it, the kind of splendor of it. It was one of the most incredible things I've ever seen. You will have had a similar experience at some point. You will have been in nature and slightly had your breath taken away by something just incredible. I have it every year. If you can see this picture, which is slightly higher quality, but still not very visible, but you can look behind you. I have it every year when we go to Keswick. We drive over, and you suddenly hit the Lake District. And when I hit the Lake District, it just amazes me every time that somewhere like that exists in a country as populated as this. You suddenly get there, and it's just like mountains and lakes everywhere, and it doesn't look like there's anyone living there. And that has the dual thing of both kind of blowing me away in terms of the natural beauty of it, but also just that sense of familiarity with it. Because we go there every year, just driving there and seeing it, but also feeling a little bit like it's home. I don't know where it is for you. Where's that place in nature that you've been and just been wowed by? You know, think of it now, wherever it is, that place you've been and you've had your breath taken away by the sheer power, beauty, majesty of the world. That's one element of what it means for God to have made a good creation. It's not the only one, though. There's many more. In Grace Church, we sometimes sing a song. We actually sang it as the song just before we came to here, which I hadn't planned at all. But I was like, we never sing this song, so I'll have to introduce people to it, and then we just sang it. But it has a bridge in it, which says these words. It says, we lift up our eyes, you're the giver of life. I'm going to tell you what I do every time we sing that bridge, and I've done for a long time now. When we sing it, I allow my imagination to run away with itself, and I picture certain things in my head. I'm just going to click through all these because you're not going to be able to see them anyway. But there you go. If you can make out anything, then do. I picture in my mind the moment that I first held two tiny little girls in my arms. It was 2010. It was 2010. These tiny little girls, and I just held them, and I remember just looking at them and just being like, this is incredible. And so I allow my mind to go there as I sing that. And then I imagine them growing up, and whispering secrets into each other's ears that I will never know about and never get to hear. I imagine Athol taking up residence in a drawer in our kitchen and deciding that this is where he is now going to live his life from. I imagine my kids crash landing on a giant swing or being blown away on a Hartlepool beach. I imagine them as toddlers being flung into the air. You know that moment where you chuck them up and they just laugh their heads off as they fall down and just have no doubt that you will catch them. I imagine them sitting on the floor, completely transfixed as they watch Frozen on the wall. That's where I allow my mind to go when I sing those words. Because that's what we mean, right, when we say he's the giver of life. We mean he makes that. You know, that life, that just aliveness, you kind of, there's no substitute for it. That vibrancy, that raw emotion, that was created by God. That was him, that life that he breathed into the world. Maybe for you it's not that. I mean, you might have a similar experience. For you, it might be kids, it might be friendships, it might be other people, but you might have people who have just melted your heart. For you, it might not be that. It might be something else. Sometimes I allow myself to dwell on my achievements in life. You know, the things I've managed to do with my life, and I find myself just rejoicing in those things. 2012 was a big year for me. 2012, the girls were, Arthur wasn't yet born at this point, so we're talking about May 2012, he was born in July. He wasn't yet born, the girls were starting to sleep, and I was still in my 20s, so I had like endless energy, and I was finally sleeping, and we'd moved down to Leeds, I'd done a new job there, but anyway, I had time to throw into something, and so I spent a lot of the early times of 2012 working really hard. Just like, I'm just going to grind out at something. I'm going to try and improve at this thing. And finally, in May 2012, I made it. And again, you're not going to be able to see this picture, but if you can, that is my score on Temple Run, right? If you've never played Temple Run, I hit 12 million almost on Temple Run in May 2012. I was sufficiently chuffed by this that I took a screenshot and have kept it for 13 years just for this moment, okay? 12 million. I don't know if you've ever played Temple Run. Try and get 12 million, okay? If any of you beat it, I'll be gutted. So don't. If you get near, just turn it off. It might not be that, though. It might be other achievements you could look back. You could... I could look back at cycling the coast to coast with Athol. Okay, cycling the coast to coast with Athol. That is like the classic sort of type two fun. You know, you're like, it's not actually fun, but looking back on it is. It's that. Like, it's type two fun. And that moment where you get to the end, you go, I achieved that. I did that. I worked hard and we got there. Or maybe it's this moment, if you can see this. That we many of you who are parents will have this moment, the moment where you manage to build the perfect train track using every bit of your brio. You know, and you're sufficiently chuffed that, again, you take a picture going, look at what I have created with my own hands. Not a piece of brio was left and every bit joins up. I don't know what it is. But you've got that. You've got those moments of accomplishment within life that you look back and you go, this is good. There was joy to be found here. This is something I look back and go, this is what living is about, 12 million on Temple Run. I could have talked about other things. I remember I went to see Jimmy Eat World with the girls about 6 months ago. I remember looking around there and just watching these thousands of people singing Hear You Me. And just seeing how transported they were by that music. It was almost a spiritual moment for these people who presumably many of them have no faith. For me, maybe the equivalent of that is on Wednesday night when we come here to sing together and we finish and we're singing When I Survey and I'm stood at the back and I'm just enjoying what I consider to be the greatest song ever written. Now, you will have different versions of that. I've told you mine. You'll have different versions of that, but you will have had similar experiences. You will have had your breath taken away by nature. You will have had your heart melted by someone. You will have felt like you've been transported by a melody. You will have felt the joy and accomplishment of succeeding at something hard. The creation, the world around us, the world we inhabit is full of wonder and beauty and joy and goodness. And this is crucial because this is why ancient Israelites came to believe in a physical resurrection. We don't want some immaterial version of that. We want a world which we can feel and touch and taste and see. That's the world we want to live in. We don't want to live in some non-physical version of this, a non-physical waterfall or a non-physical bit of music. We don't want to live in this world. We want to live in a world where we experience those things, where we feel them and touch them and taste them and see them and hear them. That's the world we want to live in. And because of that, because ancient Israel believed that the creation, the physical world, was made by God to be very good, then they said, well, then that God who did that must one day raise the dead, make a physical world which has all his goodness in again. But you'll notice a problem with this worldview, right? The problem is that for all of that, for all of the goodness of creation, creation and the world around us isn't only good. And our experience of it isn't only good. In fact, I started by talking about the Iguasha Falls. I went there in January of 2002. But in October of 2001, while I was out in Brazil, I'd had a phone call to tell me that my granddad had died unexpectedly. It was unexpected to me. I think it was unexpected to most people. He was going in for an operation, so it wasn't entirely unexpected. But people hadn't really been talking in those kind of terms. But he just never came out of it. And in October of that year, I got a letter from my gran. I'm going to read just a little bit of it, and I'll see if I can get through it. I had a little cry on Saturday when I read it, so I'm going to see if I can hold it together for this. But she writes this. She said, the unanswered questions won't be silenced. now just as I have to somehow face up to whatever life still holds without him, you have to take every opportunity to enjoy all the good things. New doors opening, fantastic experiences. She goes on to say this, it took a world war to make Grandad and I discover ourselves and each other, but the blessings have been enormous. 54 years together and still crying out for more. 54 years together and still crying out for more. That line just stays with me all the time, every time I read it. Because what she's saying there, she's saying, it feels like the goodness has been cut short. Yeah, there was so much goodness there, but it was cut short. Like it's been snuffed out. And specifically, it feels like it's been snuffed out by what? By death. And of course, that's where the Genesis story goes next, if you know it. Genesis 1 is the beginning. It doesn't last very long, this good creation. Because in Genesis 3, this serpent appears and he starts speaking lies into God's creation. He encourages people to rebel against God's good design for his good creation, to reject life and as such allow death into the world. There is so much to be said about Genesis 3 that I don't have time to talk about now, and also it's not relevant to the story I'm telling now about the resurrection. But for now, I just want to focus on how this story, Genesis 1 and Genesis 3, contributes to the belief in resurrection. And Genesis 1 and 3 make two things abundantly clear. God made a good world, and death is an evil intrusion in it. That's the story of Genesis 1 and 3. The world God made was a good world, and death was an evil intrusion into it. God's good world did not include death in it. In the Jewish worldview, death is therefore not part of some natural cycle. At this point, at least, they diverge from the wisdom of Mufasa. Death is an aberration, something that was never meant to be, something which stands against the goodness of God, which he poured into his creation. Now, hopefully you've followed me this far, because if you have, then you're starting to see the worldview which led to the emerging of a belief in a physical resurrection. If the physical world is good, something to be enjoyed rather than something to be escaped from, and if death was never the creator's intention in his world, if it was an evil which he was opposed to, then, the ancient Jew says, well, what is this creator going to do? And they say, well, surely he's not going to allow death to have the final word in the good creation he made. Surely one day he will overthrow it. Surely one day death will be conquered, overthrown, done away with. And on this day, then surely the dead will rise and the world will be made new and all that is evil and fallen and broken will be done away with and the uncorrupted goodness of creation will be restored. That was the ancient Jewish worldview. That was the hope of the resurrection that emerged in Judaism. A deep belief that the same God who spoke a good world into being was surely powerful enough to speak a good new creation into being. A deep belief that if God's intention had been for a good world without any death, then this is what his power would one day achieve. How could it not? Now, I'm going to try and wrap it up here for this week. And I'm going to try and wrap it up just by giving you three thoughts about what this means for us in terms of how we think about the resurrection. There's three things I was hoping, as we talked about this, might happen. The first is this. I want you to allow this to give you confidence in the resurrection. And specifically, I want it to give you confidence in the resurrection as you realize that a belief in the resurrection is not a belief about anything to do with you. We don't believe in a resurrection because there's something intrinsically eternal about us. We don't believe that we will be bodily raised because we have in some way earned it. We don't believe in the resurrection because of anything we have or can or will achieve. No, our confidence in the resurrection is based on the character and power of the Creator God. I think it's amazing to think that was enough for an Old Testament Jew to base their entire belief of resurrection on. The character and power of God. That was all they had to go on. They go, God is a good God who made a good world. And therefore, of course, at some point, the dead will be raised and a new creation will be brought in. But we get to see a lot more than them. We don't just have that, because we get to see how God actually achieves that. More than that, we get to see the first fruits of this resurrection. We have seen someone die and be raised. We've seen Jesus and we've seen him face head on all of the evil and brokenness of this world. We've seen him go through death and we've seen him be physically raised. We will look at that in more detail in one of the other weeks. But that is the good news of the gospel. The news that what God was always going to do, he has now done, and that we can share in it ourselves, that by faith in Jesus, by trusting in what he has done, we can share in the resurrection he has already enjoyed. So I want this truth to give you confidence in the resurrection, because the confidence is not based on you. It's based on who God is and what he is one day going to do. The second thing I want it to do is I want it to whet your appetite for the new creation. I want this to make you more excited about what is to come. Let me just be as clear as I can. The hope of the resurrection is the hope that one day all that is evil and harmful and broken and bad will be burnt away, so that what remains is only the good. That's the image Paul specifically conjures up in 1 Corinthians 3, if you want to read it at some point. He talks about a building being burnt by fire. And he says, if you've built with good materials, that will survive. But if with bad, that will be destroyed. His point being, as you look forwards, what you look forward to is the redeemed, renewed, and perfect moments. I encourage you to think of those moments earlier where your breath is taken away by beauty. Well, what we look forward to is a redeemed, renewed, perfect moment where our breath is taken away by the beauty of nature, where our hearts are melted by an experience of love, where our spirits are lifted by the sound of music. A perfect, redeemed, renewed, uncorrupted version of that. That is the hope of the resurrection, a hope which you have tasted in part so many times in your life and which we all long to taste more of. So I wanted to give you some confidence. I wanted to give you some excitement. And finally, I wanted to change your relationship with the present. I wanted to change the way you relate to the world now. Because when Jesus teaches us, you may know these words from the Lord's Prayer, to pray, your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven, we are praying at that moment a resurrection prayer. Because that is what we believe will come at the resurrection. We pray for it to increasingly be our experience here and now. We pray that we would enjoy the goodness of creation as God intended us to. We pray that we would increasingly come in line with his intentions for his world. Because we know that that is ultimately where this world is heading, the resurrection hope is not separate to our hope for this world. It is one and the same. What is your hope and dream for the world you live in? What do you wish would happen in this world? When you look at the world and go, I just wish the world was a bit more like this, or I wish the world could be better in this way. What we're talking about there is a moving towards the resurrection. We pursue justice and goodness and beauty and life and joy now because that is where we want the world to be heading and because that's where we believe the world is heading. That's why I said at the start that the resurrection is both a future hope and a present reality. Informed by what we know God is doing, we begin to experience this power in our lives now. And so, what do? We seek to put to death all that is evil and pursue all that is good. Because we know that ultimately, only the good is ever going to survive.